what I am going to do tonight is to give you a lecture which I have never given before under any circumstances, and I intend to enjoy doing it. I hope you will enjoy watching me do it, and that all together we shall have some fun together with a final project on Julia Margaret Cameron. I suppose you could say that tonight is the one in which the lecture in which I will definitively prove what a fine Christian woman she was, but also that she had at the back of her mind a recipe for our own happiness on earth as well as our salvation in heaven. Can I have the first slide, please? Here's a surprise for you. This is not quite what you expected, perhaps. It's the last, if you like, of the heroes. Last time, you see, I was talking about heroes in Victorian culture. And this is Charles Darwin, the author in 1859 of The Origin of Species, a book which caused a tremendous amount of controversy throughout the rest of the 19th century. If you were at my last lecture, you will have heard me talk about the wonderful collection of books that Mrs. Cameron gave to Alfred Tennyson, the poet, in 1859. To remind you, she gave him Carlyle's History of Frederick the Great, she gave him George Eliot's Adam Bede, she gave him a new edition of Malory's Morte d'Arthur, about the Arthurian legend, and she also gave him John Stuart Mill on Liberty. She did not give him Charles Darwin's Origin of Species. However, you see, if you read these things in detail, you wonder why she didn't give Tennyson that book, perhaps. Did she think that the book was too dangerous for Tennyson to be reading? Might upset his religious beliefs. No, I don't think so, because you see, Tennyson was already very well aware of all the new ideas about evolution, and there is another fascinating little story that I can tell you, which is that in 1868, 10 years after the publication nearly of The Origin of Species, Mrs. Cameron allowed Charles Darwin to come and spend his summer holidays in her guest house. That's to say, the house next to her own, which she rented out for money to Charles Darwin in 1868. But she told Mr. Darwin in a letter, which I found in Cambridge University Library, she said, "You must be aware, however, if you come and stay with me, that I shall be very busy at that time finalising the arrangements for the setting up of the reading room on the Isle of Wight, where I live." So you have another little picture of this great woman, among all her other duties, as mother to six children, as well as having just started photography 3 or 4 years ago. She's now also setting up a reading room for the benefit of the general public on her island. I'm sure she would have included The Origin of Species in that library. Broadly speaking, the controversy is over two positions taken by the scientists of the period. One is the creationist position, by which the people believed that God created the world from scratch, from the beginning, without any process of evolution. And against the creationists were the so-called transformationists, of whom Darwin is the most famous. Interestingly enough, as well as photographing Charles Darwin, Mrs. Cameron also photographed his chief opponent, who was the Bishop of Oxford in those days, a man called Samuel Wilberforce, the son of the great freer of the slaves in North America. Or the one, rather, who, I should say, of Wilberforce, the freer of the slaves, who started the whole process of the freedom from slavery. He didn't succeed quite as quickly as that. So she's photographing, within a matter of a week or two, or a month or two of the leading figures in the evolution controversy. Charles Darwin on the one hand, and the Bishop of Oxford on the other. The question is, where did she herself stand in this matter? What was her own view? Well, let's see in the course of the lecture where we go and see if we can come up with an answer at the end. Next slide. This is the key picture for this lecture. It's also the one on the cover of the catalogue. And by now, I think those of you who've come several times to my lectures will realize that I think very highly of this picture. What does it represent? The title is The Kiss of Peace. And I had the good fortune just a few days ago in Madrid on Sunday to go into a church during Mass and to see, I arrived at precisely the moment when people gave each other the kiss of peace in the context of the Eucharist. Some kissed each other in the family, some shook hands. But that is essentially the title that Mrs. Cameron gave to it, and it represents the position, I think, that a conservative person might have wished to take in showing such a picture to the general public in the 1860s. It would relate to the religious controversies of the so-called Oxford movement, which was a reformation of the Catholic, of the Anglican, the Church of England's own ritual in the direction of Catholic ritual. But let's explore this pair of figures, two people facing each other, one bestowing a kiss upon the other, but perhaps the relation is something which we want to explore most of all. Next, please. In my first lecture, I indicated my interest in Mrs. Cameron's attempts to create traditional images from Christian iconography, and we can see quite clearly here in the top version that she's taken two separate negatives made of glass and joined them together somewhat awkwardly here, and that after this little experiment she is able to proceed and make a picture in which the whole picture is made on one negative. In this version, you see the child is clutching a small cross. In this version, it's absent. But it's quite clear that this is the type of picture known as the Madre Pia, the loving mother who is looking at her child while he is asleep. And it's quite clearly a representation of Christ and of Mary. Next, please. Here we have it in a larger close-up version, and the cross is back in his hand on this occasion. Next, please. Now, Franceschini, the Italian painter, depicted this particular scene in this way, with the child actually lying on a cross rather than holding a little cross. And, of course, the picture is much more symbolic in its effect than the versions of Julia Margaret Cameron. Next, please. Here we have another of those crude negatives joined together in two pieces of glass in which the three Marys at the Pietà are apparently looking at the Christ child. It's a very crude picture. I don't mean to present it to you as a fine work of art, but just to show you the kind of work that Mrs. Cameron was doing to evolve her own pictures. Next, please. Here is a rather complicated one. I suppose we have here the figure of St. Anne on the right, Mary, the mother of Jesus, here, and possibly Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist. We appear to have John the Baptist and Christ in the picture also, which I can't tell you, I don't think. Possibly this is Christ and possibly this is John the Baptist. But somewhat unexpectedly, we have another child as well, which is clearly the child of the previous picture as viewed by the three Marys, and the lilies out of focus in the foreground. It's not a successful picture, but it shows you how elaborate her attempts were to create these classic Christian iconographical pictures. Next, please. This, I do believe, is a great success. It's less definite. You can't be quite sure who these people are. I imagine that these are, in fact, the three Marys, although they seem to be rather young, and that this is Christ. And the title of the picture, as I said in my first lecture, is there are two titles on different prints which Mrs. Cameron herself wrote and signed. In one, the title is The Return from the Temple, which is the occasion when Mary and Joseph are very anxious about where Christ is, and he's in the temple disputing the nature of God with the doctors, the learned doctors. The other title is simply After 3 Days. Now, after 3 days, you know, Christ is resurrected from the dead. And I suspect that Mrs. Cameron is combining in one single picture these two different ideas about the infancy of Christ, but also his death on the cross and the resurrection. Next, please. There are a lot of pictures tonight from the Prado. It's because my friend Anne and I have been going to the Prado every day almost for a week, and we've never had such great time in our lives. This version is by Murillo, and it is interesting to me on this occasion because of the proximity of the face of the Virgin and the child amounting to a kiss. So if we take you back to the first picture of the kiss of peace, what I'm about to begin to suggest is that there are very many different versions of the kiss of peace which you find in Christian iconography, and that they, I believe, finally come to accumulate to a tremendous force in Mrs. Cameron's version. It can be, in other words, Mary and her son Jesus who are giving the kiss of peace. Next, please. Here's Mrs. Cameron's version. The mouth of Mary is against the forehead of Jesus, and the mouth of Jesus is quite a distance away from Mary's mouth. But nevertheless, you see that clearly this is a kind of Madonna kiss which Mrs. Cameron has made. Next, please. This is a tricky one. There's a little bit of a trick here. If you know your Christian iconography, you realize that this goat skin tells you, together with this cross, that this is not Jesus, but John the Baptist. So who is this woman? Is this John the Baptist's mother, or is it Mary, the mother of Jesus? Wouldn't it be wonderful if Mary, the mother of Jesus, actually looked after, in this motherly way, John the Baptist? Well, certainly, if you go to one of your great museums, you'll find a picture, as I did, of Mary receiving John the Baptist from the childbed of Isabel, the mother of the John the Baptist. And I don't know if Mrs. Cameron knew such a picture or knew such an idea, but certainly this seems to be a picture in which Mary, the mother of Jesus, is in some curious relation with another child, not her own. When a mother will look after somebody else's child, you are already on the road away from heroic individualism towards something like democratic socialism. How about that for a political construction from a Christian picture? Next, please. You'll recognize this, surely. It's Murillo again, and it is John the Baptist. Next, please. A close-up of his face. A detail from the painting. I say a close-up because that's from photography, but it's really a detail from the original painting. Now I want you to see the next picture. Mrs. Cameron. Now, I don't know whether this is... I don't know who this is meant to be. I found this picture about 20 miles from London in a man's house, hanging on his wall where it had been in his family ever since it was made. It was a picture of his own father, taken by Mrs. Cameron in the 1870s. It's a very beautiful picture. It's here in the exhibition. This same man kindly lent us the picture to travel around the world and to leave his little house near 40 miles, 20 miles from Oxford. He said, there's a tradition in the family that it represents the infant Samuel. I'll ring up my brother on the telephone and ask him if my memory is right. He rang up his brother. He said, I don't remember a thing about it. This is the basis of my scholarship, you understand. Now, the point really is that it does relate to the kind of picture which we have seen in Murillo, and it could be John the Baptist, but of course it could be the infant Samuel, who himself is regarded as a type of Christ, has an experience and a vision which is of the same kind, which marks out Samuel as somebody destined for a special future. But in any case, it's a very beautiful picture, and it has this degree of spirituality, genuine spirituality, which is what makes Mrs. Cameron a great artist. Next, please. It's the rose I'm interested in immediately. But let me also tell you that underneath this picture are written the words, Study of John the Baptist. It's in fact a little girl. In under other pictures, her name is given, her name in real life. But there you are, you see, Mrs. Cameron is not worried about whether the child is male or female, particularly. And the rose and the flowers here are important because of a certain theme which occurs in the relations between John the Baptist and Mary, the mother of Jesus. In the Prado, there's a painting, I think it's by Raphael Tanzio, that's to say Raphael's father, of John the Baptist holding up a little red rose to Mary. I suspect that this is what that is. Next, please. And so when Mrs. Cameron makes a simple little portrait like this, and this time the flower is not the rose but the carnation, the way the child holds the rose, the expression on the child's face is surely, again, that kind of general feeling of spirituality, which is very difficult to locate precisely, but I think comes from the context of such paintings as I am describing. Next, please. This is from the book which my great friend Anna Jameson wrote, the one who, in the middle of the 19th century, I speak about this woman as if I knew her. She is a great woman, as great as Mrs. Cameron in her way. And Mrs. Jameson did these illustrations. And here you see we get the relations between John the Baptist in his goatskin and Christ leaning down to receive this kiss. This in a version by Botticelli. Here by Raphael, the children are sufficiently far apart. But it's this one here that interests me. Next, please. On the road to Egypt. You can tell it's on the road to Egypt because of the vegetation. This is a traditional way by which the road to Egypt, il riposo it's called in Italian, the rest on the road to Egypt is represented. And this is John, this is Jesus. Next, please. Now for a surprise. And the title here, written in, you can hardly read it, I know, the word in English, spring. The season of the year, spring. Well, it's a pity we don't have a better reproduction because you can see very well in the original that this is a little girl because her female parts are showing. You can barely make them out there from where you are, but I've seen the original and it's quite clear and obvious. So, which is Jesus and which is John the Baptist, and how is it that they're both female? It's not a very important picture in its own right. It seems to me, though, it was too dangerous to give it a religious description, partly because of the nudity and partly because of the femaleness of the of this little girl here. But you can see Mrs. Cameron is experimenting with this idea of two figures in relation to a third person, the mother, and it's really a very traditional theme, and spring is just a generalized way of referring to it. Next, please. Here it's the same, but quite clearly now she's interested in making nude studies, studies of the nude figure. And she gets a chance to do this with young children in the way that she can't do, of course, with adults, not in the middle of the 19th century as a woman photographer. This picture is called, if I remember, Goodness. Well, it's not, it could equally be called Youthful Sensuality, or The Beauty of Young Flesh. It could be called all sorts of things. But it seems to me that the pattern which it follows is the pattern of Mary with John and Jesus. Next, please. This, of course, is a version of the Madre Pia, but the expression on the face now is so sad, and the eyes of the child are so closed, as it were, that you can look forward not just to the moment when the child is born and the mother is loving it. You look forward to the time when the mother will know that the child is dead and she will grieve over the body. In other words, it's an anticipation of the Pietà. Christ, whether he's 6 months old or 33 years old, it doesn't matter. Time, in this biblical sense, is pressed together, compressed. Next, please. This is in the Prado. Van der Weyden is the painter. And of course, it's this relation here which we were talking about in the context of Botticelli. And now, if you begin to see what I'm driving at, you'll realize that one version of the kiss of peace is in fact the final kiss of the mother for the dead child at the Pietà, the child who is now the man. Next, please. This is, as I told you last time, in my last lecture, I said I found this particular photographic reproduction at the end of the album which Mrs. Cameron gave to her eldest and favourite sister. And it is a Pietà by Bartolomeo. And it's the curve of the body here which is of greatest interest to us now in relation to the next slide, please. Now, next slide. This is a version, excuse this mark here, this is just a piece of damage. This is a version by Piambino. And the legs this time are slightly raised here. See the way the knees come up and go down to make this triangle here. It's, in other words, slightly different from the Bartolomeo, but essentially the shape of the Pietà, the physical shape of the Pietà. Next, please. Mrs. Cameron. The title is The Sleeping Endymion. Endymion, who is a child who is visited from the heavens at the time when he sleeps at night. And here it seems to me that Mrs. Cameron has interfered with the surface of her paper by suggesting that something is coming from the heavens, coming out of the sky in the form of cloud. I suppose, though, you see, it's this knee here that is interesting me in relation to the Pietà. The child's eyes are shut. The back is, because it's a child, it's not so spread out as it would be in the Pietà. But it's these knees and this element here from the sky. Next, please. You didn't expect that, did you? That's a shock. That's a painting by Titian in the Prado, Danae. And the shower of gold which is coming from the sky here. But I suppose it's these clouds that are interesting me a little bit. as well as the relation of this knee. But what am I doing? I'm making something which is otherwise very religious and a very holy image of the Pietà, a rather classical and sensuous image which has nothing to do with the Christian religion. But what I am suggesting is that the sensuality that Mrs. Cameron was interested in making her pictures of spring and of goodness with the little naked children, is carried over into The Sleeping Endymion, and that there is a degree of sensuality which Mrs. Cameron is willing to express through young children, and that the general shape of the Pietà can be found in a sensuous picture like this also. This is very experimental, you realize. I said this is why the lecture I hoped would be fun. It's also why, of course, you mustn't believe every word I say. But speculation is the greatest pleasure in life, isn't it? And these clouds up here, they're very convincing in a way. The theme is very convincing. Next, please. For once, we have a picture which comes from England. After all the pictures from the Prado, I can show you a picture which comes from the north of England, from a little seaport called Hull, H-U-L-L. Not a very beautiful town today, with the sea industry, the fishing industry in a poor state, but nevertheless, a nice little museum with this picture in it by somebody who is really unknown to me, called Niccolo Renieri. 16th century, and really quite disturbing. We made a slide from a postcard. That's all we got, just a little postcard, made a slide of it. And what do we have? We have actually Saint Sebastian. And one of the arrows is being removed. But Saint Sebastian is being attended by two women. And it seems to me that it's very likely that the theme of Saint Sebastian is transposed or transformed partly into the theme of the Pietà. The picture becomes somewhat erotic, I think. Not only in the positions of these arms as they're thrown back in death, but in a sort of pleasure, but the delicacy with which the arrow is being removed by the woman's hands right here. I think this is also potentially a little erotic. Now, this is, again, a subject which is difficult to talk about and be accurate about. But let's pursue the theme just a little bit further. Next, please. Here we are with one of your paintings from the Prado. This is Ribera, Saint Sebastian. Next, please. Now, this is something different. But what I wish to suggest to you is that something strange is going on in the picture, nevertheless. This little boy is normally the boy that plays the part of Jesus in Mrs. Cameron's work. He was the little boy in The Return After 3 Days. Here he is as Cupid, but as you know, Cupid is God of love, the classical God of love, and I suppose Christ is the Christian God of love. The expression on this child's face is not, I think, the kind of expression you would normally expect to find on Cupid's face. It's a little too sad for that, a little too thoughtful. Mrs. Cameron has almost created a nude study. He's almost losing his loincloth. And he has a bow and arrow. Now, what is possibly the connection between Saint Sebastian, who receives arrows into his body, and Cupid, who fires them? Well, that is perhaps the kind of relationship which exists in a kiss. One gives the wound and one receives the wound. Think about that. Next, please. Now, the relation of this woman's head to this figure in this position suggests surely something of the Madre Pia, something of the Pietà. But it's not actually. It's Psyche, the classical goddess of the imagination, chiding, or what's the right word, correcting, chiding, giving somebody criticism, criticizing Cupid, and removing his wings. That's Mrs. Cameron's title. But I think you can see, if you came to my very first lecture and you understand the principles of typology, by which you can transpose a story from one era of time to another, successively, from the classical era to the Christian era, by way of the Old Testament and the New, and then finally to the Arthurian era, that typological way of thinking makes it possible for us to at least consider the idea that this is a version of the Pietà. Oh yes, the knees are crossed this time, it's slightly different. It's not exactly like Endymion. It's true, there are all these minor variations, but that's what I think it probably draws some of its strength from, the idea of the Pietà in the context of the classical story. Next, please. Now we have the kiss. And the title here, Cupid and Psyche. This is Cupid giving Psyche the kiss. Psyche with the butterfly. Her imagination flutters like a butterfly. Mrs. Cameron was fascinated by this contour of nose and cheek and mouth. It was a theme which clearly interested her as much as it did the great Italian painters. And here, I suppose, you could see this as Christ giving his mother a kiss, if you wished, but she chooses to call it Psyche and Cupid. Next, please. Noli mi tangeri by Correggio in the Prado. And now I introduce a new element. What have I done so far? I've introduced the idea of the kiss of peace embracing the notion of Mary, the mother of Jesus, kissing her own child in youth and in death. I've included the idea that Cupid can be related to Saint Sebastian. I would go further eventually and say that Saint Sebastian can be related to Christ because Saint Sebastian too is tied up against a pillar where the arrows are fired into him when Christ is tied up against the pillar to receive the flagellation. You have a very similar shape of the body. And now in a way we're talking in terms of shapes of the bodies. Formal attributes, formal aspects of the painting which convey the meaning in a way that you wouldn't expect. Here, what interests me, now I introduce another factor. I'm introducing the Magdalene figure, Mary Magdalene, who here is approaching Christ and he says, "Don't touch me, don't touch me." He refuses contact, he refuses anything like a kiss. We can tell it's Mary Magdalene because those of you who've been to my lectures before now know that Mary Magdalene always has long hair. Next, please. This is the rather distracted, distraught version of the Magdalene in the person of Ophelia from Shakespeare's play. And she's wearing a kind of smock or dress with flowers here and there, which we would associate with the pastoral, idyllic tradition of English country life. Next, please. And now an illustration of Tennyson's poem, The May Queen, and I think it suddenly becomes rather ambiguous. The hair is long, and so you could argue that she's a type of the Magdalene. Especially if you read Tennyson's poem and realize this young woman is about to die for reasons which are not explained. But this rosary, this garland of flowers, suggests at least one other possibility. that this hat will one day be removed and this garland will be placed on it. After all, that is the legend and the story of the English spring festival of the May Queen, when the prettiest girl in the village is crowned with the May flowers, the flowers of the month of May. Next, please. But you see that this tradition of the garland, which is also the rosary, occurs in the context of Jesus and his mother Mary too. This picture by Rubens and Bruegel in the Prado. And so what I'm suggesting is that the girl who is the May Queen, she can be interpreted as a Magdalene, but it's possible also to see her as the woman who will finally be crowned, the crowned mother, l'incoronata, the mother of Jesus, at the end of, if you like, of her life. Next, please. This is in the National Gallery in London, and it's by Guido Reni. And it shows us, I think, quite clearly that the idea of Christ on the left and John on the right, John the Baptist by the goat skin, by the cross and so on, that the idea that they are wholly male figures is not necessarily maintained. That the idea that they could be androgynous figures, neither male nor female, or rather female with long hair, this is quite possible in the tradition. Next, please. Just up the road from where we are now, at 122 Serrano, is one of the finest little museums in Europe, if not the world. Lazzaro Galdiano. This is by Leonardo, and there it is, tucked away, hidden on the first floor as you go in, around a corner, next to a painting which we haven't identified, in which Christ leans forward and touches John the Baptist under the chin in a very loving movement, like you do with your girlfriend or your boyfriend, and you tuck them under the chin. An amorous relation. But that's when you go to the Galdiano, you'll see that one next to this one. That's the point. The point of this, though, is that this is Leonardo's version of the young Christ. And I think we're not so very far away from the idea that Guido Reni gets later, and in the picture which I showed before. And the idea of maleness and femaleness is not important. Next, please. See, a puzzling little picture, not necessarily one of the best, but by now, this picture is never identified at all, usually. But by now, we can almost teach ourselves who these people must be. And I suppose this is Jesus. He is sometimes shown with his hands clasped like that. And I imagine that this is John, who is meant to be in the Bible some 6 months older than Jesus. That this is a little girl, I have no doubt. What sex this person is, I'm not sure. The flowers are the correct roses, carnations as well. But the hair is long. So we have now a strange additional element of longer hair in John the Baptist than in Jesus. That is usually the case. Next, please. And I remind you what this lecture is all about. It's about this picture, this one picture. This woman is the Magdalene type. Next, please. See, here she is, as the Magdalene, but also, in another version, as the angel at the tomb. The angel at the tomb where Christ is buried, who is present when the great stone in front of the tomb is rolled back and out of heaven strikes like lightning this great shaft of light to inspire the angel, who is normally a man, of course, who is here in the person of Mary Magdalene, who is the woman in the kiss of peace, who is in the John the Baptist position. Next, please. You saw this last time, and I told a story about it last time, which I won't tell this time. Because this time I'm interested in this relation between the long hair and the turban, which makes it possible for us, rather like the May Queen picture, to see this girl as either the Magdalene or, through those beautiful pure eyes, the Madonna. It's very difficult to choose. The Madonna and the Magdalene are interconnected in Mrs. Cameron. This is a wonderful thing, I think. It's wonderful because it should suggest to all women that complete purity is not necessary and complete sinfulness is not your fate. In fact, all of us combine all the time these two polarities of purity and sexual knowledge, which in this picture achieves finest expression in Mrs. Cameron's work. For those of you who weren't here last time, let me just say this person is given the title Beatrice Cenci. She was a girl who committed incest with her father, conspired and plotted against him with her mother to murder him, and was herself put to death. You could say martyred, if you wanted to. Martyred, Saint Beatrice Cenci, as a result of all this terrible knowledge. But here she's presented to us, I think, in the same way as the May Queen is, only here in an Italian tradition as opposed to the May Queen in the English tradition. Next, please. This is a much quieter and more beautiful picture for those of us who wish to contemplate in a quiet way this figure. It is the Magdalene figure, you can tell, the lowered eyes, but there is the headdress, which has this very slight natural halation, photographic halation around the top here, which provides a natural halo. At her breast, she clutches a bunch of lilies of the valley, which are symbols of purity. They are slightly out of focus because they're not so important to Mrs. Cameron. What is important is that we can see the difference between the long hair and this white covering to her head, and we know that we do have here another version of a combination of Magdalene and Madonna. Next, please. It's in the Prado. It's Raphael's The Visitation. The Visitation is the moment when two women come together to share the knowledge that they are both pregnant. Mary is quite clearly pregnant. Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist, is not so obviously pregnant. In one little picture we found in the Galdiano today, a Dutch painting or a Flemish painting, you can actually see here in the tummies, in the stomachs, little round pictures of the embryos. And what are they doing? They're shaking hands, which is part of that Eucharistic ceremony, which takes one form as the kiss of peace to the face, but can also take the form of the handshake. In some versions, of course, of the Visitation, you actually find Elizabeth and Mary kissing, as in the kiss of peace. So now we have another element, and the next element is the theme of the Visitation. We have these various themes of people kissing each other under different conditions in the history of Christian iconography. Next, please. Mrs. Cameron. not identified usually. Nothing written underneath this picture. It doesn't say what it is. But by now, you and I know what it is. It must be the visitation. It's very beautiful. Next, please. This in a somewhat English style of, again, country life. But clearly, these are the mothers of these two children. And although, again, the picture is not entirely successful, I don't quite like the expressions in these eyes much. Nevertheless, you can see that this is the pattern on which he's building. These are clearly Elizabeth and Mary, and these are their respective children. Next, please. Now, here's one for you to solve for me, because I don't understand this picture. They are both carrying bunches of grapes. Now, I have seen one picture. I think it was at El Escorial, actually, but we've all forgotten where we see things now, of Christ on his mother's knee, holding a bunch of grapes. You know, sometimes he holds an apple. Sometimes Mary even holds a pear. I'm not too sure what these things mean. Because, you know, iconography is not my speciality at all. But it seems to me that it's possible that this is a version of the visitation. But if any of you in my audience, my faithful audience, here some of you four times running, if any of you know what these grapes might signify, well, tell me afterwards. You see, I haven't solved all the problems at all. There's still plenty left over for other people. But I suspect they mean something. But let me also say something to you now, which is that I think it's less successful when they actually have attributes, as they're called, these attributes which signify a specific meaning. This is what I would call emblematic iconography, whereas Mrs. Cameron's last picture, the two women in white, embracing in that way, without any signs of who they are, without any grapes, is somehow more impressive in a way. In other words, she believes in suggestion usually, and it's rather unusual that you discover her introducing elements like this which need to be interpreted and give us problems. Next, please. This is from the album of Sir Henry Taylor. If you remember, Sir Henry Taylor in my last lecture was the one with the enormous beard who looked sometimes like Jeremiah and sometimes like Heraclitus. His album is in Oxford in the Bodleian Library. And underneath, in his handwriting, not hers, we see the words, "The Twin Star." The Twin Star. And then above it, because he crosses out the word twin, and he puts above it the double star. Quite interesting, that. The twin star, the double star. Well, if you were thinking in terms of John and Jesus, yes, indeed, they would be stars, but that they are twin together, or that they form a double, one half related to the other half. This is a little problem of language which Sir Henry Taylor has had in trying to decide which to write underneath it. Should it be double or should it be twin? If it's twin, it means that they are somehow connected by birth but separate. If they're double, they're somehow connected altogether, completely connected. Next, please. This is in the Prado. It stands more or less next to another most wonderful painting in the Prado by a man called Bernardino Luini, heavily influenced by Leonardo da Vinci, and in which John and Jesus, this is John, because look, there's the goatskin, this is John, this is Jesus. Here in this version, which is a copy of the drawing in Paris by Luini, it's attributed to Andrea del Sarto. It stands, as I say, in the Prado, quite close to the version by Luini, in which the lips and noses are even closer than they are here. And what I'm suggesting is that it is this particular picture, or the version by Luini, which Mrs. Cameron, somehow, by some miraculous means, has come to know. Next, please. Here's another version in Sir Henry Taylor's album, this time with no title underneath it. But you see the way in which the noses are interlocked, and the mouth and the chin close to, in close proximity. I suppose this one is John. I suppose this one is Jesus. It doesn't seem to matter. Well, when you say something like that, you realize you've got yourself into a new political situation. When it doesn't matter whether it's John or Jesus, it suggests that there are two people who are involved, that there is a double, and that the interaction between the two is more important than the individuality of the one. I am sure if there are any serious theologians in my audience tonight, at this point they will get really upset and really worried. Because you see, I'm not a professional theologian either. Next, please. What I've been trying to say to you all evening is that these two figures contain within them Mary Magdalene, John the Baptist, Mary the mother of Jesus, and that this figure, who is Jesus, is also Jesus of his infancy, of his death, and may even be related, at the most extreme, to the sacrificed figure of San Sebastian, the man who receives all the pain, and the man who, in the form of Cupid, gives all the love. And then, when I say the man, I realize that I've fallen into the old male chauvinist trap, and that really we're talking about two women. And that these two women, no, they're not those people that I've just described at all. They are Mary, the mother of Jesus, and Elizabeth, the mother of John the Baptist. It's quite a little story, isn't it? Next, please. That's the end, you see. Before I finally go and leave you, I would like to say a word of thanks to my friends and sponsors here in Madrid. Afterwards, I shall be outside in the exhibition to receive any questions and suggestions as to the meanings of grapes and other such things, and any other questions you might wish to ask me about Julia Margaret Cameron. But I would like to say, first of all, thank you very much indeed to the Juan Marc Foundation and all its leaders, all its workers, whose names I could probably recite in bad Spanish if I tried. I mean, of course, the Director General himself, Señor Juste. I mean, Señor Capa, who organized the exhibition so beautifully. I mean, my friend with whom I cannot communicate a word in Spanish, who serves me so well every night, Señor Tejero, the master of the slide machinery. My my superb translator up there, who will now be embarrassed by these words, Signor Maya, who is frankly the most brilliant translator I've ever known in my whole life, and we should receive the applause that you might give to me. At the end, let's give it to Signor Maya. And finally, to somebody whose second name I can't pronounce at all, but who is known to me as Lalaya, who is our friend and guide inside the museum at all times. All those people have been so kind in their visit. You, my audience, who have come back so often, are equally kind, frankly. I hope you weren't too disappointed tonight that you didn't get Idols of the King, and I hope you found it interesting to discover that when Mrs. Cameron is confronted with Charles Darwin, she starts to transform her thinking, and I believe she begins to modernize her Christianity. And the whole import of what I'm trying to say to you tonight is that she seems to have seen the story of Christ as involving other people, and that John the Baptist is just as important, and that Mary Magdalene is a very important person, as important as Mary, the mother of Jesus. When I said last time that heroic individualism had its dangers because it invested too much power in the single figure, tonight I'm able to conclude, I hope, by saying that when you have two people involved, you have the beginning of some kind of development which itself leads to a wholer and happier life than if we rely on any single one. It is, after all, one of the great themes of Victorian literature. The man called Coventry Patmore, who reviewed Mrs. Cameron's work, who wrote about married and love and parental love, he was surely onto something extremely important and quite consistent with Christian belief when he decided that, in fact, the right way to perfect one's life was, first of all, to try to live with somebody happily. I hope you all live long and that you live happily with each other for a very long time too. Good night.